Sanskrit is a very interesting language. because simple changes in a letter can change completely the meaning. Just like this word mudra means urine, but putra means a son that's capable of delivering you back home to God. They both come from the same place. They both come from the genital. Putra and mudra come from the same hole. Yet one, because it's useless, is urine. And one, if he follows religious process, is putra, he can deliver you. And a son that doesn't follow religious process is also called mudra. Purnam, full of. Mat, besides me. Upaiti, devotes oneself to. Ka, what woman? Anya, other. So, very interesting. Here, Pingala is describing this house, you know, and saying how the soul lives in this house made with nine doors and all these unpleasant things. I'll read the translation, it's interesting. This material body is like a house in which I, the soul, am living. Okay, so we all accept that, I hope. The bones forming my spine, ribs, arms and legs are like the beams, cross beams and pillars of the house. You know, sometimes when you go to a house they don't have lining on the roof, so you can see all the, you know, all the beams and things up the roof, or old churches and things like that. And the whole structure, which is full of stool and urine, is covered by skin, hair and nails. The nine doors leading into this body are constantly excreting foul substances, just like you see, you know, stool, urine, you know, phlegm coming from the nose, saliva, things coming from the ears, things coming from the eyes, you get wax coming out of the ears all the time. Besides me, what woman could be so foolish as to devote herself to this material body, thinking that she might find pleasure and love in this contraption? Responsively, please. This material body is like a house in which I, the soul, am living. The bones forming my spine, ribs, arms, and legs.
The bones forming my spine, ribs, arms, and legs.
I like the beams, cross beams, and pillars of the house.
I like the beams, cross beams, and pillars of the house.
And the whole structure.
And the whole structure.
Which is full of stool and urine.
Is full of stool and urine.
Is covered by skin, hair, and nails.
Is covered by skin, hair, and nails.
The nine doors leading into this body. Are constantly excreting foul substances. Besides me, what woman could be so foolish as to devote herself to this material body, thinking that she might find pleasure and love in this contraption? So, a very interesting statement made by Pingala here. She's actually expressing her realization of the nature of this body. And how it is actually, as it says, Tridatuke, a cup of, what is it, Yashapna Buddhi, Kunpe Tridatuke, how it is just a bag of three elements, bile, mucus, and air. That's all the body, you know. I went to an Ayurvedic doctor the other day and they look at these, you know, kapha, pitta, vayu, you know, and that's how they determine what the body is in good health, is the balance of these things. So it's just a bag of elements, really. That's all it is. And when you hear descriptions like this, one may become a little bit reflective or introspective and think, well, yes, this is very interesting because it's actually what the body is. It's just a bag, it's got bones and skin and nails and all these different types of things, hair. And it's actually full of unpleasant things. You know, like coming from the eyes, you get, like right now I've got this thing in my eye and there's constantly this stuff coming out of the corner here that's very irritating. Or sometimes you get things coming out of you, you might wake up in the morning and find a little bit of wax on the pillow. You know? Or sometimes if you have some stomach problems, and you know, especially in Indian, one can't control their bowel movements and things like that. Just come out. So we see that the body is actually
embarrassing situation, a very embarrassing thing, yet we're so attached to it. We're so attached to this material body, and to the point where we think, this is me. And that is evinced by our actions. We look at the way we act, and we're always acting to try to please the body. And if I'm not this body, what's the point of trying to please it? You know, Prabhupada, he once told that story of the bird in the cage. It's like someone's taking care of the gold cage and looking after the cage very nicely, but neglecting the bird within the cage, and the bird dies. This is, you know, anyone who looks at this, you know, from a removed perspective will look and see, this person's foolish. Look, they're just polishing the cage to keep the cage very clean and seeing that the cage is taken care of, but they're neglecting the bird. In the same way, the living entity is taking care of the body. You know, you can go to any shopping centre, you go up to Albert Park, any of these shopping centres around here, and you'll see how many shops are dedicated to looking after the body. You know, to these hair salons where they spend hours and hours and hours sitting there getting their hair fixed, or, you know, they have these fingernail salons where ladies sit there and like, probably men sit there too, I haven't seen them. They get their nails painted and they get all these fancy designs, but they're there for hours and hours and hours, you know, on the hope that someone might look at their fingernails. And after all, what is the fingernail? It's mala, it's an exudation from the body. It's an unclean thing, but they're so attached to it. And their hairstyles and all these, you know, like sometimes you see these big sort of, you know, hairstyles that come out of this, so people look at them. And they're just attached to trying to make the body look more attractive. And this is a most foolish situation. Yet we see that everyone in the world, practically speaking, is bewildered by this misunderstanding. Yet Pingala, by the mercy of the Supreme Person of Godhead, was actually able to realize. You know, because she was also, sometimes you see, if you go like up in St. Kilda here in Grey Street, you'll see the ladies of the night, you know, they're parading themselves up and down the street. And you go, you know, our temple in Sydney used to be in King's Cross, so you regularly get to see, you remember the King's Cross temple, you regularly get to see these ladies, you know, just because, you know, the temple was in Darlinghurst Street, and that's one of their main districts, is Darlinghurst Street, and also around the corner where the Brahmachari Ashram and the Brahmachari Ashram was, that's where many of them used to live, was up in that area. So you got to experience a lot of it, and they're just parading their wares, basically. It's like, you know, some, like in India sometimes, you get these merchants that come around to the houses and they've got their bicycles, they've got all their different buckets and things, and they pull them all out and they show all their wares. So these ladies are saying, they're just, you know, they're just parading their wares up and down, hoping to find customers. And she was doing the same thing. Yet by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, she actually came to understand the reality of her situation in the material world. And it's very interesting, if we go forward a few verses, actually in the next chapter, we see there's a comment that Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur gives from Srinath Maharaj. And I understand that Gopa Vrindesh was talking that how Pingala became realized, or how she received the mercy, is that Dattatreya happened to sleep in her courtyard. So there's more to it than that, actually, as is explained. On Srinath Swami's commentary on verse 32, which Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur quotes in his Sarata Darshini. And it's very interesting. He says, Srila Srinivasa Swami gives evidence from Srimad Bhagavatam that the Brahman Avadhu was actually the incarnation of Godhead Dattatreya. Really interesting, huh? Really interesting. The Bhagavatam 2.7.4 states, Yad Pada Pankaja Paraka Pitriva Deha Yoga Yim Akur Ubayim Yadu Hayayadha. So he's saying, you know, the many yadus, haihayas, etc., became purified by the grace of the lotus feet of Dattatreya, the Lord, that they attained both material and spiritual blessings. So this yadu mentioned in this verse is yadu. Haihaya means Kartavirya Arjuna, and adya, others, arka, pralad, etc. You know, so many people actually receive this. So this verse mentions that yadu was purified by contact with the lotus feet of Dattatreya. So Dattatreya is Datta, the son of Akri and Anasuya, because Anasuya prayed to the Lord that the Purusha, the Guna avatars, would appear as a son, as a children. Now, some people misunderstand that, and they think that Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva combine in the form of Dattatreya. According to the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, that's incorrect. Her sons were Durvasa, Soma, and Dattatreya, or Datta. His name is actually Datta, but Dattatreya means Datta, the son of Atri. Yeah. So Soma was Brahma. An incarnation of who?
Brahma.
Yeah. And Durvasa?
Shiva.
And Datta?
Vishnu.
This is the verdict of the Bhagavatam, fourth canto. It mentions it twice in the first chapter of the first canto, fourth canto. But some people wrongly assume that it is all these persons put together. So it's also interesting that we see here that Pingala, by the association of Dattatreya, became very devotional. She's actually saying, you know, my whole life I've wasted in trying to enjoy my senses, etc., yet I should actually be using my existence for the pleasure of Krishna. And we see others like Haihaya, the king of the Haihayas, which was Kartavirya Arjuna. He received the benediction of Dattatreya. Does anyone remember what his benedictions were? You don't remember? Kartavirya Arjuna, you've got 1,000 arms. Yeah, he got a benediction of 1,000 arms from Dattatreya. And he also received mystic cities, actually Astasi, I think he received. He received Astasi from Dattatreya. And interestingly enough, he became very, very puffed up from that. Now, Dattatreya is actually, the Lord has two main features or two main ways that he expands. And one is called Vaibhav, which is partial expansion. So you have Vaibhav, Prakash, Vaibhav, something quite complicated. It's explained in some detail in the second chapter of the Adi Lila. But he also has Prabhav. So the Prabhav incarnations are full incarnations of Krishna, full expansions, like plenary. And they're equipped with potency. So Dattatreya was actually a Prabhav incarnation of Krishna, and the Prabhav incarnations, that they manifest opulences of the Lord. So the opulence that Dattatreya manifests, the same as we see with Kapila, was knowledge. So his and we see here how he's imparting knowledge to this to the other. Yet, interestingly enough, Dattatreya was an impersonalist. And Prabhupada also points this out clearly in several places in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He was an impersonalist, so the knowledge he was presenting was impersonal knowledge. And as we see, because one may wonder how it is that Pingala is becoming devotional, whereas someone like Kartavirya Arjuna became very, very puffed up by his opulences. So this is explained quite clearly in the, I believe it's the fifth canto, or is it the fifth or the tenth? I forgot. Yashasti bhakti bhagati kinshana sarai guna satra sarasati subraha hara bhakti shakutu bhagavana manatina siddhara bhagavati. That all the demigods and their exalted qualities, such as religion, knowledge, etc., become manifest in the body of one, and the demigods themselves actually become manifest in the body of one who has developed devotion. Bhakti bhavati akinchana. There's this akinchana, there's this unmotivated devotion to Krishna. So it would seem to me that because Dattatreya is presenting impersonalistic philosophy, then when he was presenting it to Kartavirya, he didn't get Kartavirya Arjuna. He didn't get the devotional sense of it. Therefore, it didn't actually harava bhakta shakutu mahapuna. It didn't actually produce any good qualities in him. Rather, he gained the knowledge, he gained the mystic cities, And he became puffed up by his increased power. He had 1,000 arms and he thought that he could fight with anyone and kill anyone. So he became puffed up by this situation. Whereas it would seem that Pingala, she had some devotional intent, some devotional proclivities, and this, you know, she received the mercy from Dattatreya, and this inspired her and sort of propelled her into becoming a very developed devotee, you know, an advanced devotee of Krishna. So it's quite interesting the way that things like this develop. And yet, we also see it, it's also explained in Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's comments that the first, I can't remember how he wrote it down there actually, I'm trying to assist my imperfect memory, but because we see here there's how many gurus is there? Anyone remember how many gurus? 24 gurus, right? So the first group of gurus, such as the pigeon, fish, deer, the young girl, the elephant, the snake, the moth, the parara bird, and the gurus are teaching what to avoid. See, it's interesting because oftentimes devotees may think, well, you know, we can only have one guru. Yet, and this instruction is supported by the statements in Shastra and supported by statements of Krishna. Yet we see here that this Avadutta, who is actually Dattatreya, is accepting many gurus. And it is true that one has one Diksha Guru, one initiating spiritual master, yet one may have many Siksha Gurus, and those Siksha Gurus support the instruction of the Diksha Guru, who is generally the primary Siksha. So it's not that we just have one Guru and we only ever hear one person, we never hear anything. Just like, you know, we attend the Bhagavatam class, we hear people speaking the Bhagavatam, and so in a sense we're accepting that Siksha, that instruction. We hear Srila Prabhupada, we read Prabhupada's purports. We're accepting that Siksha. So it's saying, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur is, well actually it's again from Sridhar Swami, that those gurus were teaching us what to avoid, whereas the bee, the honey collector, and Pingala teach what we should avoid and what to accept. So what is Pingala teaching us to avoid?
Attachment.
Huh?
Attachment.
Attachment
to what? Man.
What was she looking for ultimately? What was she trying to get? In the previous verse, it explains
money.
That's half of it. What's that verse there in Balishtha? The first verse where Pingala speaks, right? Because I cannot control my mind, just like all I desire pleasure from lusty from an insignificant man. So she's actually after money. But also, she was approaching these men and thinking to have them as her lover. Right? So she was looking for sense gratification. So she's teaching detachment from sense gratification, you know, from money and from sex life. You know, the money, essentially what we have money for. So we can enjoy our senses, we can use it to, you know, indulge our senses in various ways. And she also taught, what was she teaching us, what to pursue. Like we'll see exclusive devotion to Krishna, not just devotional service, but exclusive. Like she's talking in this Rame Rame, I can't remember which verse it is. She's saying that, you know, if I follow this process, oh here it is, yeah. This Rame Nena Yata Rama, just like Yata Rama, just like Lakshmi. Rame, I will enjoy the Lord just like Lakshmi. So Lakshmi has this service relationship where she sits at the Lord's feet and massages the Lord's lotus feet. So she's saying that, you know, if I have this, therefore I now pay the price of complete surrender and thus purchasing the Lord, I will enjoy with him just like Lakshmi. That's in two verses' time. So she's also teaching us. She's teaching us that we have to be detached from material enjoyment and we need to become completely attached to the lotus feet of Krishna. And then we also see the earth teach what items should be accepted. So, yeah, she teaches this complete detachment from the Lord, from material nature and attachment to the Lord. And we see that, you know, also again, you know, we can accept instruction from, just like, you know, she's pointing out, the Brahmana is pointing out all these things in the world which we should avoid. We also see that in the Padma Purana, Rupa Goswami, he quotes this verse, Smakavya Satkam Vishnu Vishnakavya Nijatachit Sarvahidinishyavishu Etiyoriyavikinkara. So that he's saying that the primary rules, the primary regular principles of devotional service is to always remember Krishna and never forget him. And it's just Sarvahidinishyavishu, all the rules and prohibitions support these two principles, or a service to these two principles. So we see that there are many instructions, just like if we go through a nectar devotion, we look at the 64 items of devotional service. The first 10 are things we should do. The next 10 are things we shouldn't do. And then there's a further 44 items of aspects of devotional service. So the idea is that with the 10 items we should do, these help us to remember Krishna. And the items that we shouldn't do help us not to forget Krishna. So in the same way, Dattatreya is highlighting these things, you know, I've learned from these gurus how if I, just like the moth, you know, that was I found that very interesting. Or the fish, you know, also the bait on the hook. But just like these living entities, if I follow the example of these living entities, I will be trapped by the material nature. And I will be, you know, doomed in this existence. So we see the same thing, that the prohibitions are there. Don't do this, don't do that, etc. To help us to not forget Krishna. So the same way, you know, if we start to hanker to enjoy material things, and actually it's explained in these purports that this hankering for this material enjoyment is the source of all suffering in this material world. And if we give up these examples, if we give up these the attachment to these things, then actually this will bring us happiness. Because we see, when we're trying to enjoy something, we develop so much anxiety because we might lose that thing. We might lose that opportunity to enjoy it. Just like we see that, you know, like rich people, they often have very big fences around their house, and they have security cameras and barbed wire and dogs, etc., etc., because they're fearful that someone may come and steal the things that they've worked so hard to accumulate. But we see a poor person, what do they have? They have nothing. And are they fearful that anyone's going to steal what they have? Not fear at all. And I find that interesting, because often we find that when rich people go to poor countries like India and Indonesia, and they see poor people on the streets, that they become disturbed. And they can't see, you know, they can't bear to see these poor people on the streets because they're thinking they're so unfortunate. But one who's actually realized can understand that actually it's the rich people who are unfortunate, because they've got all these material attachments that they're so attached to and they're so fearful of losing. Yet we see the poor person is generally satisfied with what they have. So actually, they're in a better position. And there's a story that Prabhupada sometimes tells about, what was his name? Krishna. Maybe it was Krishnadeva Roy, I'm not sure. He's the person that Krishnaraka was named after. He was the king of that area. Do you know what his name is? Krishnaraka was named after him. Maybe it was Krishnadeva Roy, I don't remember. Anyhow, there was this Brahmin who was living in his kingdom, and he approached this Brahmin one day and he said, you know, is there anything I can do for you? He says, you're living a very, you know, difficult existence. You know, and I want to do something for you. He says, no, I have nothing. I don't need anything. You know, I'm here, I have my cottage. You know, my disciples, they go out and beg, they bring me some grains. I live under this tamarind tree. My wife picks the leaves, she boils up with the water, and we can drink tamarind water. I'm happy, I have everything I need. You know, so he had nothing, yet he was completely satisfied. You know, by material standards, he had nothing. But the thing is, he had the greatest wealth because he had knowledge of Krishna. And this is actually the greatest wealth. And it's interesting because there's a story, I think I told this some time ago, who was it? Srinivas and Shamananda and Narottam, they were going to
from Vrindavan to Bengal site, and they were taking their handwritten copies of all the Goswami's literatures, and they were taking them to that side of India to distribute the knowledge to people, you know, on that side. And there was this one kingdom in, I believe it was in Bihar, and this king had an astrologer who could see that, you know, if people were carrying great wealth or not. And then this king, he lived by robbing people who entered his kingdom. He had a band of dacoits who would go out and rob people. And so when they entered the kingdom, they had a caravan, and the caravan they had all the books, the copies of the books. And this astrologer said actually that there's a group of sadhus who've entered your kingdom, they're carrying the greatest wealth. And so he had his dacoits go and rob them, and they stole this in the night time, actually, they stole all the books. And they brought it to the king. They didn't know what it was, they just took the wagon and had all the wealth in them. They just thought it was going to be gold or money. And then they showed it to the king, you know, the king came and looked at the books. He said, what kind of wealth is this? This is useless. But actually, later he became a disciple of
Srinivasa.
I think Srinivasa became a disciple of, later he became a disciple of Srinivasa, and then he realized actually what wealth it was, because it was the writings of the Acharyas, the six Goswamis. So he actually at that point realized what it was. But for a materialistic person, they're considering wealth to be, you know, temporary pleasures, temporary opulences, and money, wine, women, song, beautiful house, beautiful car, beautiful wife. All these things which are ephemeral, they come for some time and they go. So they have this very, very sort of fleeting perception of what happiness is. And we actually understand that everything in this material world, the happiness is temporary. It's dukkhalaya shashvatam. Shashvatam means it's temporary, by nature full of misery. This is the nature of this world. But someone is actually understanding. You know, and she's saying that here in these verses. We'll see it in the subsequent verses. She's saying that, you know, like, I was thinking I was going to find my happiness in this material body and in other material bodies. And I was putting all my focus on that, trying to develop happiness and trying to derive happiness from these temporary things. But the temporary thing can only bring misery, because in the end it is bound to dwindle and vanish. Just like, you know, you might have a nice car. Yeah, or it's interesting in the purport here, Vidyan Maharaj talks about the nature of this material body. And just like that, it can be sucked out. I've seen in my life, you know, several times people being killed in various ways. And it's just one moment between life and death. It's just 1 minute they're alive, 1 minute they're dead. I remember when I was maybe about this, 18 or 19, I was driving down Logan Road in Brisbane, which is, at those days, was what was now the Princes Highway. And I was, you know, going on the inbound lane towards the city, and I was turning right, and there was a motorbike. No, hang on, there was another car in front of me. And he turned right in front of me to go down the side street, and this motorbike was coming down the road, and he didn't see the motorbike. Bang, the side of the car, and I was killed instantly. Just like that. 1 minute, 1 second of his life, and next he's dead. And then in Rath Yatra in Sydney, were you there that year? That lady was killed?
Yeah.
I was standing like, you know, maybe about 4 foot in front of the car, and just grabbed the rope, so I'm just about to go on, and this lady came up, she offered a basis to Prabhupada, she offered pranams to Jonah, and then we got the word to pull the car, so we started to pull the car, and next thing you know, she's under the wheel. Mm-hmm. And the wheel just went up on the side of the head, and there was blood and stuff all over the street. Instantly, dead. Just like that. That's the nature of this body. It's such a fragile thing. You know, we're thinking, especially when we're young, we're thinking that I can never die, nothing can stop me, you know. I'm so strong, I'm this, I'm that, you know, so full of vitality, etc. And we're thinking that we can go on forever. But just ask any old person how they feel about that one, going on forever. You know, I remember speaking with my mother-in-law some time ago, just after her 90th birthday, just saying, I hope I leave soon, because I have enough of this. You know, the body becomes quite difficult when you get older. And when you're young, your body functions well, you're somewhat full of vitality, you don't actually sense the body. You know, you just active, but you don't really sense the burden that the body is. But as we start to get older, you know, the pain in the knee, pain in the back, pain in the hip, you know, I get headaches, I get this, I get that, heartburn, you know. All these things are coming, and you start to sense the inconvenience of the body. But when we're young, it's not so easy to sense. But it's very nice, you know, because we have these realizations that are you know, given by Pingala, by the mercy of Dr. Trey, and she's expressing how much difficulty or how much, you know, the body is actually just a bag of suffering. What the body is made of. I mean, you just analyze what the body is made of. You know, she's describing here, you know, it's like bones and mucus and nails and skin, fat, blood, pus, stool, urine. You want to enjoy that? There's that story, another story Prabhupada also tells about liquid beauty. You know, where there's this man who wanted to enjoy with this beautiful young woman. And she decided to take some very, very extreme purgatives to separate her beauty. And so she took these purgatives and she was vomiting and passing stool, etc. for several days. So she told him to come back later, come back in a week. And so he came back and he saw this, like, what to him looked like a haggard old woman. And he said, "Where is that beautiful young woman I came to enjoy?" And she said, "I am that beautiful woman. I am that same woman." And she said, "No, this can't be true." And it's interesting that she had, you know, when she was vomiting and you know, when she was purging, she sank it all in pots. And then she said to him, "There is my beauty. If you want my beauty, there it is in pots." And he was repulsed. And then she preached and became realized. So, you know, I mean, these stories are there, but the problem is for us is we need to hear these things again and again and again and again, because we're so conditioned to this perception that I am the body. That even though, oh yeah, it's a very nice story, but, you know, always, there's always a but. There needs to be a degree of realization. Just like I was listening yesterday to a lecture that Prabhupada gave in Vrindavan in 74. And he was talking about this verse, Prithiviti Achiyata Nagarami Gram Sabat Rapacha Hobi Moranam. Lord Chaitanya was saying, "My holy name will be heard and chanted in every village of the world." And then Prabhupada was saying that actually you need to accept this thing, you need to accept this verse as it is. And he wasn't saying it, but in other places he said that, you know, his godbrothers couldn't understand how this would happen, how the Lord's holy name would be heard and chanted in every town and village of the world. But we see by the Krishna conscious endeavors of Srila Prabhupada that the holy name indeed is being heard and chanted in every name and village of the world, because he had the faith that this would happen. He had the faith that this was the instruction of Lord Chaitanya, therefore it would come to pass. And he just executed the instructions of his guru, and it came to pass. So in the same way, if, just like we see Pingala, this Brahmana Avadut is taking, you know, he's obviously taking the instruction, or the lesson he's giving us is he's taking the instruction of his guru, and he's seeing how the instruction manifests in so many different ways in the material world. You know, the honeybee, the hunter, the prostitute, etc., etc. So many different things, the moth. He's seeing how these instructions are manifest. So in the same way, we read these things in the Bhagavatam, we hear the instructions of the acharyas and Srila Prabhupada, and then we need to see in the material universe how these things are manifest there. We need to constantly remind ourselves at every moment of every day about the instructions of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because the instructions of the Srimad Bhagavatam are meant to bring us to the point of God-realization, are meant to free us. As it mentions in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, that those who are, you know, caught up in the dense darkness of ignorance in this age of Kali shall get light from this Purana. And we see that these stories in the Bhagavatam are constantly highlighting the difficult situation of an embodied living entity in this material world. And it's said, you know, even in the Gita, it mentions how difficult it is for those who are embodied to achieve self-realization, especially if they try to follow the impulse of the past. There's that verse in Kings 12:5, pleasure because they shall have yet pleasure to keep the sun. But it's very, very difficult for them to achieve realization, particularly when they follow the impulse of the past. So we need to be constantly reminding ourselves that every moment, every day, you see something, oh yes, that is just like the story in the Bhagavatam, where the Lord says, or where Sukadeva Swami, or whatever, you know. Try to be constantly reminding ourselves of the Bhagavatam in action. Because it's not a static book. It's not just like, you know, you go up here, you read this digest, the Woman's Day, or something, it's like some boring, mundane story, and it's like, you know, it's there for a few minutes, it's gone. Just a waste of paper, basically. Whereas we look at something like the Bhagavatam, and it's living. I mean, I'm sure we've all had the experience, I've had the experience so many times, where I'll just open the one of these books up, you know, the Bhagavatam, the Gita, the Sisi, any page, just randomly open it up, and you know, this, I'm reading something that's speaking to me, something that's happened in my life right now at this point, and I need to hear about this. It's the same when, you know, so often we may be listening to a class, or a Prabhupada giving class, or a speaker giving class, and we might think, oh, that's very interesting, but he's not talking to me, he's talking to somebody else. But actually, we need to see how the Bhagavatam is speaking to me directly. It's just like in the Gita, and even in the Bhagavatam, Krishna has presented this knowledge for the benefit of all of us, all the conditioned souls. Not for, you know, like Arjuna. Arjuna didn't really need this, because why? Arjuna was Krishna's, you know, direct personal associate, Narayana Rishi. You know? And it mentions in I think it's in a, I can't actually remember where it was, I was reading it a while ago, in relation to that verse about the moth being attracted to the flame. And there's another story that I found very interesting. I can't remember the story. But in that story, it was quoting how that all living entities in this world, except Narayana Rishi, are attracted by sex. So don't be surprised that you have this sex attachment, right? Because only Narayana Rishi, Arjuna, is Nara. Krishna is Narayana. So Arjuna is not an ordinary personality. So there's no question of him being bewildered, there's no question of him being illusioned. But Krishna created that situation where it appeared that Arjuna was in bewilderment, so that Krishna could speak the Bhagavad Gita to him. The same with the Bhagavatam. You know, the Lord created a situation where Parikshit Maharaj, you know, became angry and, you know, put the snake around the neck of the Brahmin so that Sringi would curse him. So that Krishna create the situation where the Bhagavatam would manifest. Why? Because we need it. We're in Kali Yuga, we're situated in the deepest of ignorance. And these stories that are presented in the Bhagavatam help us to get out of that ignorance. Actually, the only thing that's going to help us get out of that ignorance is this, you know. It says this is Puranaka Vidaha. This is brilliant as the sun. It's just like when the sun rises, you can't help but see everything. So when the sunshine of the Srimad Bhagavatam arises within our heart, then things become clear. We understand our situation as it is. So it's important that we remember, you know, like all these examples, these 24 gurus, they're so applicable to us in this day and age, and if we just remember how these living entities, or how these different examples are being explained by Dattatreya, then it will help us also to become purified in existence and to see how I'm being affected by these things. And if I just follow these examples, if I just learn from this, then I can overcome the influence of material nature. Another thing I find very interesting here is that Dattatreya, he's obviously wandering incognito, as was often the case that various sages, you know, with Rishabhdev when he left the kingdom, he was wandering in Kali. You know, Sukadeva Goswami also was wandering around naked and, you know, just, you know, not presenting themselves as being great personalities and not, you know, constantly, you know, like generally you find that there's two different types of transcendentalists. There's Bhajanandi and Groshanandi. So Bhajanandi tends to keep things very, very inward, very internal. Whereas a Goshtinandi will preach a lot, and that way people understand that they're great personalities. So that we see that here with Dattatreya, it's obvious that he wasn't understood that he was a great personality. Yet he's presenting himself as being just, you know, a humble sage. And you know, even when he meets with Pingala, that Pingala becomes realized by his mercy. Yet he's presenting that I've understood this by the mercy of Pingala. So he's also manifesting great humility, that actually Pingala's realization comes about because of him, but he's saying my realization is coming about because of her. So again, you know, he's manifesting the qualities of humility and not presenting himself. He's not saying here, well, I'm the Supreme Person, I've got it, and I say this. Whereas sometimes we see Krishna does say that. And just like we see in the Gita, it says Bhagavan Vacha. And you know, in other places we see how Krishna does, you know, in some circumstances he reveals himself as the Supreme Person of God, in other circumstances he doesn't. According to time, place and circumstance, whatever's going to be the most effective in assisting devotees to realize the transcendental path. So my understanding of what is going on here is he's done this to assist the other in realizing the transcendental path. It's quite interesting. You know, the more the story unfolds, the more you learn about what's going on here. It's just amazing. It's really amazing. Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions at all?
I have one comment in conclusion. My comment is that these transcendent yogis and devotees, they knew so much, they are nothing of the human beings. They are talking about the spine as the central beam and chest as the cross beams and the limbs and are the pillars. You know? So such a good description. So they have really full knowledge of anatomy also. So whatever they are saying is absolute truth.
Mm.
What you mentioned. That's my comment. And my question to you is, how the Satraya, being an impersonalist, could give the knowledge of Krishna to Pingala? This is what he is.
But he's not an impersonalist.
Mm. You said impersonalist.
He's presenting impersonal philosophy, he's not impersonalist. Right. He's Krishna. How can Krishna be an impersonalist?
So how are you presenting this?
Because he had a specific purpose, just like we see Buddha. Buddha was also an incarnation of knowledge. But Buddha came to present a particular he came for a particular purpose to it's explained by Acharya that he came to take people away from the Veda because the Veda was being misused in order to justify animal sacrifice and things like that. So it's not always, completely clear why, at least to the non-devotees, it's not completely clear to them why the Lord manifests this, or how can this be incarnation of Krishna? He was doing this, he was doing that. But the Lord's purpose is not always so transparent. So obviously he had a purpose in presenting knowledge, and we see that, based on the nature of the person he was speaking to, that he got different results. And it may be, I don't know, because I haven't come across any commentaries where the Acharyas discuss that. Like with Kartavirya Arjuna, how he got knowledge and blessings or benedictions from Dattatreya, he became very proud. Whereas we can see, obviously, Yadu, because, at the end we see, at the end of the next chapter, we see how Dattatreya is glorifying Yadu. And the Yadu dynasty is the dynasty in which Krishna appears. So obviously a very glorious dynasty, obviously devotees of Krishna. Otherwise, why does Krishna appear in that dynasty? Right? And we see Prahlada. Also mentions, in another place Prabhupada mentions how Dattatreya was speaking to Prahlada. So Prahlada, we understand, is a great devotee. And we see here with Pingala, obviously, a very surrendered devotee. So, why it is that the Lord manifests himself as impersonal, I don't really know. Yet we see that, he preached to specific people to achieve a specific object, to achieve a specific outcome. Like with Kartavirya Arjuna, he ultimately wanted to diminish his pride. So he came before him and gave him certain benedictions which would ultimately lead to his pride being defeated. Whereas with Pingala,
she was so absorbed in trying to enjoy her senses, and she wanted, you know, she was trying to have, because it mentions in this word, is that in the previous verses, the last word of the verse is balishya, which mentions that she was very childish. Her sort of mentality was childish and foolish. She was thinking that every one of these men is my lover. You know, and she actually had no discrimination about who she would enjoy with. Even though the lowest of men, she didn't care. She just wanted that, and she would see them all as her lover. But more so, like, generally prostitutes just do it for money. And that's all. There's no exchange of emotion at all. It's just it's very sort of cold. But then, in this situation, it's mentioned about how she just actually saw them all as her beloved. You know, so then Dattatreya came to, for some reason, you know, and you know, if one were able to you know, investigate the situation further, you may find that in a previous existence she had formed some kind of piety or some kind of activity which situated her in such a way that she could get the benefit from such association. There's always a reason behind these things. As explained, I believe it's by Vishnu Chakravarti calling his, I don't think it's the Madhuri Kadambini, one of those books where he explains that, you know, the mercy of the Lord is never causeless, the mercy of the Lord always has a cause, whereas the mercy of the devotee is causeless. So it would seem, you know, there was obviously a reason why Dattatreya came. It's not just by chance. Krishna does something, it's not by chance. Nothing the Lord does is an accident. So there's a specific purpose he had in being there to give this knowledge to Pingala. And it seems to me that she must have done something in a previous existence, or even in that existence, to warrant getting that mercy. It's just like we're all here in this room, we're all listening to the Krishna conscious philosophy. Somehow or other, at some point, we've done something that's qualified us to receive this mercy. Rupa Goswami mentions it in the second chapter of the Nectar of Devotion. The fact that we're performing devotion service now means we've done it before. Something else? I guess I have to read it carefully. I have to read it carefully. It's not a short. The nine doors leading into and out of the body are the two eyes, the nostrils, the mouth, the two ears, the genital, and the anus. Vangsha, or spine, also means bamboo. And indeed, the skeleton appears to resemble a bamboo construction. Just as bamboo can be immediately burnt to ashes or chopped into pieces, similarly the material body, which is constantly deteriorating, may at any moment be crushed into powder or cut into pieces, drowned, burned, suffocated, and so on. And it's a really good analogy, because I remember in my court, usually before Gopanim, they get these really, really big winds. Huge winds. And whenever you've seen this, right, when the big winds come, they have all these bamboo things they make for the, you know, different things, tents and things like that, completely flattened. And this is a really good analogy. It's just like bamboo. When something strong force comes, bamboo is finished. And so in the same way, when something, you know, just like, you know, if you walk out in the street, you get hit by a car. Bhakta was telling me when he was living on North Road, they saw this horrible accident. They actually saw it happen, where the car just hit the person, dead. And it's so quick, just bang, like that, gone. We need to be aware of the fallibility of this body. Do not think this body is eternal. Do not think this body is indestructible. It is so temporary. And in the slightest of things, you know, even a tiny little bug, yeah, of this swine flu that's going around right now, it's just a tiny, tiny microscopic bug gets into your body and kills you in a most unpleasant way. How strong, how indestructible are we? We actually are. The soul is indestructible, but the body is temporary. It's a temporary manifestation of material energy. Material energy is also a temporary manifestation of the Lord's the Lord's energy. So we need to contemplate these things regularly. And this is why this story is so nice, because she's contemplating
the temporary nature of the body. She's contemplating how I foolishly tried to enjoy this body. And we're all doing exactly the same thing. We're all trying to enjoy. We're all trying to extract some kind of nectar out of this pile of stool. And it's just foolishness. Because there's nothing to be had. There's nothing to be had there. This is like puna 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 java the java. Repeatedly chewing that which has already been chewed. I chew something, spit it up, you pick it up, you chew it, you spit it out, the next person. Who does things like that? Huh? It's just like in my pool, you get this dukkha, this stick, and it has all this like sticks in it. So you chew it, you suck the juice out, and you put it down on your plate. Now, if someone else came along, picked it up, and started sucking, you think, what is this person? They put it down, and someone else comes along. You think they're crazy. Yet that's exactly what we're doing. This whole material universe, it's already been enjoyed to its maximum potential, and still we're trying to enjoy it. And things become very, very jaded. It's like, you know, on the sometimes, you know, you have the, like, I was ringing up yesterday, and we're making some cupboards over at home to go in the wardrobe, some shelves to go in the wardrobe. So I'm ringing up this wood place down in Dandenong, really good prices. And, you know, they put you on hold, so what do they put you on hold? They play on the radio, they play all those, like, old songs. I mean, like, playing these songs from 30 years ago, you know, I mean, and just repeatedly chewing that which has already been chewed. I mean, when it was new, it came out, it was interesting, but now it's like 30, 40 years old, and they're still playing the same old thing. Don't they get sick of it? No. It's such unpleasant stuff, you know. Eventually the body must disintegrate, and therefore there is certainly no one as unfortunate as one who has dedicated himself heart and soul to this flimsy body, which is filled with unpleasant moments. There is no one so unfortunate. But don't think that's not talking to us, that's talking directly to us, because why? We've dedicated ourselves heart and soul to enjoying this body. We've dedicated ourselves. We make it look nice, we pamper it up, we do this, we do that. You know, we dedicate ourselves, heart and soul. And it's just filled with all these unpleasant things. So it's a wonderful instruction for us in this section of Bhagavatam, as in all other sections. But very, very nice. And, you know, I encourage that we should try to meditate upon these instructions constantly, daily. Every time we have these experiences, meditate. Oh, this is just like, you know, this story in Bhagavatam. Because you'll see these stories are related to every facet of our lives. Every time something's going on in our lives, you can see something in the Bhagavatam that is explaining it and helping us to understand why we suffer like this, why I enjoy like this, why I feel this way, why I do this, why I do that. And the more we're able to reflect on it, the more we develop attachment. And the more we develop detachment from these material things, because we're engaged in the devotional process, we'll concomitantly develop our attachment for Krishna. It's not that you can have attachment for material life and attachment for spiritual life at the same point. They don't work. It doesn't go well together. We need to give up our attachment for material life and then develop attachment for spiritual life. Okay. Thank you very much, Gautama Srila Bhagavatam ki. Namaste Bhakti Devi ki. Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai Nitya Ho Premananda.